Hey, welcome back to the Terry Summers podcast. It is a pleasure to have you. I have always had a desire to make people laugh since I was a little bitty kid. And I created a career kind of around that as a comedic actress and comedian. But I love to laugh. And today, you're going to meet the person that does that for me. Makes me laugh. Today's guest is iconic to me. He is iconic because he brings me one of the greatest gifts I know, and that is laughter. This guy makes me laugh so hard and always. From pretty much the day I met him. His name is Ben Tyler. Ben is an actor, a director, a writer, a father, a brother, a husband, a son, a friend, and I'm sure a bunch of other things. But he just has it. For me anyway, and I think for lots of people, because he just has timing and a dry sense of humor. But whether he's playing a role in making people laugh and just knows how to hit that money spot with a line, or if it's just his personal sense of humor, he floors me. He floors me. I laugh so hard at Ben Tyler. And I'll tell you what, that puts him up way up there on some kind of pedestal with me, because I really love to laugh. And sometimes, you know, I mean, I laugh at a lot of things. I mean, I think I have a funny bone that works both ways. You know, like I think that I probably can help others laugh. I think if I say that honestly about myself, but I also laugh relatively easily in general. But this is a different kind of laugh. This is the laugh that I couldn't stop if I wanted to. He just has it, and it tickles me, and it's a dry sense of humor. It's this interesting brain that chooses to say something that I guess you need to track or understand that kind of humor, maybe not, but I share about a line that I still go back to in this interview that I can just think about. I've even copied him, but I can just think about it and it makes me giggle. So you're going to have to listen to the whole thing so that you can hear it. But you are going to, of course, love Ben Tyler. I just think everyone should love the people that I love, or will love the people that I love, not should. And I am pretty certain that that's going to happen here. I am so tickled to have him. And he and I met, just so you know from the get-go, he and Candace Miles wrote Gov the Musical. And if you listened a few weeks back about my experience that brought me to or kept me here in Arizona, so he's part of what made that happen. And I love him. And I love him so much. So get ready. Get ready just for a lovely time. He's just wise and fun and smart and a good guy. You're going to love Ben Tyler.
Ben.
Hi, Terry.
Oh, I'm recording. I know we visited good. Before I pressed start, but I got to tell you, my friend, that I see right away this wave of emotion comes up. You have left such an impression on my life for so many reasons, and I know we're going to talk about that, but one of them is that I dare say anyone will ever bump you from this. You make me laugh.
Oh, well, thanks.
Literally, I mean, I have a lot of funny people in my life, and I'm sure you do too.
Sure.
But you make me laugh more than anyone ever has, and more consistently, and always to the same funny bone in me that nobody knows how to do. And it's just you. You are just so funny and so smart. Have you always been that way?
I don't know that I could say that much, but I can tell you that it has always, performing has always been part of me. And the earliest thing I can remember, you're probably way too young to remember a children's television program called Romper Room. Do you remember, have you ever heard of Romper Room?
I'm not going to answer that until you repeat that I'm probably way too young one more time.
Way, way too young to remember Romper Room. When I was a kid, it was a television program that was syndicated across the country. It had the same format in every town. But what it consisted of was a group of preschool kids with an adult female teacher. And they would do activities. They would march around on stick horses or draw pictures or, you know, things like that. I watched it every day. And at the end of every show, the host, who in Phoenix at the time was a woman named Miss Sherry, would walk up to the camera and say, "Hey, kids, if you'd like to be on Romper Room, tell your mom to bring you down and audition." And every day I would go and grab my mom and go, "Mom, I want to audition for Romper Room." I was six. I couldn't have been any older than six. And I finally just wore her down because my mom was no kind of stage mom. She had no interest or understanding of it at all. And I finally just wore her down. And so she took me down and I auditioned and I was on live television for a week. And I felt extremely satisfied and happy from doing that. So I just know it's just something that's been in me. And I was a problem kid on Romper Room.
Oh my goodness. I didn't know I was going to get into some dirt this early.
Well, it was a live show and you've got about 8, 6-year-olds to deal with. And we were marching around in a circle with our stick horses and the girl in front of me was not moving fast enough for my taste. So I took my stick horse and actually hit her over the head with it on live television. And Miss Sherry stepped in and stopped everything and told me that I was being a don't be. You could be a do be or a don't be. Do be, of course, is not a marijuana cigarette. It was a kid who was behaving properly. So I was being a don't be, and I had to apologize to the girl, and I felt just awful because I had the hots for Miss Sherry. And I had displeased her, and it made me feel small.
Did they air that?
Oh yeah, it was live.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
It was live TV.
Oh man. Did you make a lot of friends with that or did you lose friends after?
In my neighborhood, my friends were like, I was a superstar.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say you probably had to be.
For a week.
Yeah. Even though you beat the girl up in front of you.
I didn't beat her up. It was the soft head of the horse is what I hit her with.
Yeah. Okay.
I wasn't caning her. I just
sure. It was just the soft part of the horse. Yeah. Let's move on. okay. So Ben, I don't really want to do the math because the math does say that I, you know, am old. Old, yeah. Definitely older.
I'm older.
Yeah. Maybe not by much. I know we have a birthday in the same month, but I do remember that. Yep. I met you, and we did before we settled on how and when to get you on my podcast. We sort of just reviewed because we had to drag the cobwebs off of it. But we met in late 1990, right?
Yes.
Isn't that what we determined? Yes.
That's right. And you were doing the Chekhov 1X at Mill Avenue Theater. That's the first time
I forgot about that. Yes.
That's the first time I remember seeing you perform as an actor.
But I actually met you. I met you before that, and you offered me the opportunity to be in that. But I met you because you were actually stirring the pot, if I recall, When did you start writing the show that we'll announce here in a minute that brought us together?
Well, it was right about that time that I think that the one acts, those Chekhov one acts went up. We were working on the script. I say we, me and Candace Miles, my partner's wife, were working on the script at that time.
Okay, so let me just draw back a little bit. I want to say that you are a playwright. You are an actor. Mm-hmm. Definitely have made a name for yourself as a voiceover actor, as well as stage and television. You've done so much. A director. What else are you? I know you're a husband and a father.
Yes. Well, I, you know, before we started recording, I started explaining to you that all this stuff behind me here is because I have, in about 3 years ago, started working as an audiobook narrator.
Awesome.
And so that's the way it's always been for me. I've never had just one job. I've always Right. had multiple jobs because it just keeps things interesting for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's an, I mean, and kudos to you for always having that. Because I,
Thank you.
You know,
it's daunting sometimes.
Huh?
It's daunting sometimes, as I'm sure you know.
I do. And I'm sure, you know, partnering with someone and raising a family and all of that, I mm-hmm. didn't have children, and that adds another component to it, but yeah, just in yeah. terms of being responsible. But I get folks sometimes, you know, wanting to know, what have you done and how famous are you? You know, that question comes from folks or like, you know, little children sometimes, and sure. I understand that. But really, to have made a living in our career, no matter how many different mediums you have to take on, that is really successful. I mean, I know there's that. I remember getting some information from SAG that like 97%, like an average of 97% Screen Actors Guild members, at least at that time, were unemployed, a certain percentage of, so like, it really is about making everything happen. And you have been like a king of that, particularly in the Valley.
Well, you know, thank you for saying so. And I don't take any huge credit for that. I think I just, acting was the thing that I was attracted to first. But I realized pretty early on that you can't afford to be a one-trick pony. Mm-hmm. You have to have multiple things that you can do, and so that you always increases your odds of earning that paycheck. So that's why I diversified early on, was just I thought, if I can't just depend on acting, I've got to do other things. But I was fortunate enough, I think, to find related jobs related to performing right. theater somehow.
And your giftedness. Now, you did stand up too for a while, did you not?
I did. Yeah. I did. I did that for about 6 years. And, you know, once again, I started doing that because it was fun. I didn't have any aspirations of being a road warrior, and I don't think I ever wanted to be just a stand-up comic, but it was fun to do. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. Well, dude, you are so funny. So, okay, so we kind of laid the land a little bit. Okay. I came over here to Arizona. I had friends here, and my mother had moved here, and I was heading out. Alan Pruitt, I was heading out and I saw an audition. I think I shared this with you and I shared it with our listeners, an audition for A Christmas Carol. And I had such a soft spot for A Christmas Carol in general, because that was yeah. one of the very first shows I ever did in California at South Coast Repertory. I did Amadeus. That was my first professional show. And wow. then I did A Christmas Carol, and it was just something magical. So I was sort of thinking, I wonder if, you know, this would have the same magic. And I was on my way back to California, pulled over, auditioned. Alan Pruitt pulled me inside and said, I'd love to have you, but it's this little part and blah, blah, blah. So I stayed and played Mrs. Cratchit, and I met a gentleman by the name of Jim Caldy. And Jim called, he said, you've got to meet Ben Tyler.
I never knew that.
Yes. And was he not working with you around that time in late 1990?
Yes.
Yeah. So he gave me a thumbnail view of what y'all were doing and explained that there might be something in it for me. And so when I met you at a warehouse, that Mill Avenue Theater, which we'll talk about that in just a second, y'all used for whatever, right?
A rehearsal space, construction space. It was just a warehouse. Yeah.
Yeah. And then that was the beginning of our relationship. I think we did a little something where you said, I'm looking for a gal to play Rose Mofford. And you explained. And you said, you know, I don't really want you to say anything. And I was like, okay. There's nothing really written for her right now because she's not that big on making speeches. So can you just get up there at a podium and act like you need to say something, but you don't have anything to say? So I did. We had a good time. And from that, you invited me to be a part of it. And then I think then you said, hey, would you like to take a look at the other show? And I did that in the interim before we started rehearsals for Gov, which I totally forgot about that. What was it again?
I can't remember what the name of the piece was, but it was a collection of one acts written by Chekhov. And they were absolutely hilarious. And you were so damn funny. Do you remember what the scene, the one you were in, the one that I remember anyway, was about is one you were a playwright who had written a play that had 40 horses and 100 men in it and, you know, that sort of thing. And then the other one was you were engaged to this guy and you were supposed to... Jerry Ferraccio.
Jerry Ferraccio.
And the argument was over your wedding endowment thing about land and hunting dogs and things like that. But, oh, my gosh. And so much of that was humor that was not on the page. It was just the situation as it came up being rehearsed and things like that. And I just remember laughing a lot at that.
I remember laughing, too. And I'm so glad that you reminded me of that. It has come to mind a handful of times over the course of the years, but I did forget that that was the first thing that I did for you guys. So, I am going to have you back because there's so much to you and you're just so fun.
Sure.
If you want to.
Absolutely. Are you kidding?
But you, tell me, and I know the story loosely, but tell me about the beginnings of Mill Avenue Theater, because as I was thinking about spending time with you, I was thinking you guys really struck out, meaning out ahead, not as a strike, and you and made a name for yourselves as a theater that was super creative and just super good, like the stuff that you did. And I learned of that kind of as I was catching up, you know, in the rehearsals with Gov, the history that you had. But tell me about the start of Mill Avenue Theater.
You know, our model for that was so different than the way things are today when I think about it. Bruce Miles, my partner, and I had been in a couple of shows together that were successful enough that we knew that they could have run for a lot longer than the 3-week run that we had scheduled. But the thing was, any theater that has a season has a schedule. And this show is going to live here for 3 weeks, and then we have the next show coming in after that. So we did something, looking back on it, that was kind of crazy. And I think the reason we did it is because we just didn't know any better. But some of it turned out to work pretty well. We wanted to open a theater where a show could run for a long time. So we didn't have a season. We didn't announce a season. We went from show to show. And you know, when I talk to young actors about that today, about a show that runs for 6 months, for 8 months, for a year, or longer than a year, for 2 years, it seems impossible. It just seems completely impossible for something like that to happen. And today, it would be impossible. But there was another theater in town called Actors Lab in Scottsdale, and they were running things like Six Women with Brain Death, Nonsense, shows like that that ran for well past a year. So we wanted to open a theater that we were looking for shows that had a potential to run for a long time. That was the basis of the whole thing. And we were, in theory, a for-profit theater. We were not a 501c3 nonprofit theater. So we opened it with Greater Tuna, which Bruce and I played both roles because then we didn't have to pay anybody. And we certainly didn't pay ourselves. And then we brought in something called Tomfoolery that ran for about 9 months. And then we brought in Rocky Horror Show, and that ran for a long, long time. And along that way, we had kind of hit a ditch, a giant speed bump, where we were so strapped financially that we didn't even have the money to pay for a royalty for an existing show. So we figured, okay, well, you know, we had been at it at that time for about 3 years, and we thought, rather than just pack things up and go away, we're gonna take one more shot at it and see what we can come up with. So Evan Meekum, our governor of Arizona, had just been removed from office, but his wake was still out there disturbing the force and everything. And so we decided to write something about a musical review about the foibles of Arizona politics, and specifically its governors. And, you know, Ev Meekum was the guy that everybody had thought of as being kind of a nut job. But then we started doing research, and we found out that far from being a nut job, he was kind of right in the curve with everyone else that we had had as governors in different ways. So we put this thing together called Gov the Musical, and my gosh, I mean, if anything was ever a perfect storm, that was it. The right people came together at the right time in the right place, and it was seismic. As you know, you were there.
Yes, I was there. And I had, I know that you guys have to, when you look back, say, wow, what happened? But I thought so too. I mean, I hadn't really moved to Arizona. I was, as a matter of fact, I got a ticket driving in a lane I wasn't supposed to be in on the freeway. And I fought it. This is right when we had just opened. And I fought it. And when I went before, the judge, and she, because I was saying, hey, I'm not a resident here. You know what I mean? But like the Arizona law said, if you have a job, you have so many days, blah, blah, blah. And she said, well, what do you do? And I said, well, I'm an actress, and I'm in a show called Gov the Musical. Well, oh my goodness. I mean, she just started talking about that. And I'm like, let's keep this going. Maybe I can get out of this ticket. And so and then I said, well, let me see if I can get you tickets. She goes, don't say that.
You're right.
And I go, oh, you know what I mean? Am I innocent? You know, whatever. But so I just, that's how it impacted the state of Arizona. Everybody. I mean, remember we used to joke because we would hear people say, it's halftime. Remember, yes, the audience, right, members? And mm-hmm. So we knew we were drawing a crowd that had no idea of the culture of theater at all whatsoever.
And that's what maintained that show, is we had tapped into a vein of people. We were getting the regular theater crowd, but then above and beyond that were people who would never step foot in a theater in their life.
Exactly. And it was magic. And you and I talked also, and I said I would love to have a reunion because I wasn't even thinking about the fact that it's 30 years. So I seriously am going to try to reach out to all the original cast.
30 years. That's amazing.
Isn't that crazy? I mean, it's crazy. Yeah. And see if they would do a podcast, all come on together, you know, maybe coming up in a few months.
That would be awesome.
Super fun. Wouldn't it be fun?
Yeah,
so I've been trying to reach out to a few people and see if we can, you know, dust off the cobwebs, like I said. But
yeah.
So can you tell me about the thrill? And I guess I'm putting words in your mouth, but I'm assuming it was of those feelings when that first week, if my memory is correct, weren't we getting the news down there at the theater? And when I say down there, it was on Mill Avenue, obviously,
right,
in Tempe, and you occupy the upstairs portion of a historic building, correct?
It was at 5th Street and Mill Avenue, and it was called the Tempe Hardware Building, and it was one of the oldest buildings in the valley.
Seriously?
Yeah.
So when things went nuts, what did you guys talk about?
Well, I can tell you this, as you know, I think, you know, one of the many things that we were blessed with is we had a guy show up to play Ev Meekum, who was his doppelganger, who could have been his drop-dead, absolute, identical twin. So when we started the publicity, before the show had even opened, we were still in rehearsals. We had been sending out pictures of Dick Jonas, who played Evan, and our phone started ringing off the wall. And we were sold out several weeks in advance before we even opened. And at that point, I started to get very concerned because I thought, if this is not successful, if this show sucks, we're going to make the biggest flop splash in the world because we've sold all these tickets. And if it's no good, oh my God, are we going to look stupid? So, the first weeks, the response was just shocking. It was off the scale. People just, you know, I think part of it was that Arizona, people who lived in the Valley had gotten so tired of just being everyone's doormat, the butt of every joke, because of things that had happened with Evan Meekum, things that had happened with Fife Symington. It had been nothing but bad news for so long that to have the chance to laugh at it was like this medicine that just revived everyone and made them feel so good about it. And I didn't recognize that until we got it up in front of an audience that was going to be the reaction, that it was not just funny. In many ways, it was therapeutic.
You know, hearing you recall it that way, I remember, of course, you know, being on stage and feeling that laughter. As a comedian, I know you know what I'm talking about. We get tuned in to the types of laughter, yeah. Even the way that it rolls and when it's starting to come down so you can come mm-hmm. in and deliver another punch. But there's also feelings of laughter. And you hit the nail on the head. It was medicinal. Oh, I got chill bumps just saying that, because the kind of laughter was like other stuff was coming out with it, you know? And sometimes, I mean, we would wait and wait and wait for the laughter to die off.
Yeah.
You know, and then there was a scene, I guess, was it towards the end of the first act where we all, or no, it might've been somewhere. And it was in the first act where we went up into the crowd there. Do you recall that? Where we sung yes. from, and you could feel that, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? When they would look up at you, you mm-hmm. just felt this thing that was above and beyond, not to take away from the show because it was very funny and very well put together. But you could feel how important it was that everyone was there enjoying themselves. And yeah. then that made them come back and see it multiple times. But well, then it yeah. happened that actually revived it yet again. Because I do remember you sitting us down as a cast. And for me, it was pivotal because I was trying to get an idea on when I would go back to California. Mm-hmm. But I had this beautiful, lovely bird in my hand, you know, you asked all of us if we would proverbially sign up again to hang in there because the ticket sales were so strong. It was after a show. We were sitting around on the perimeter of the stage. Mm-hmm. Do you recall that when you first
came
to us?
I sure do. Because
you didn't want any to mix the mojo up at all.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, no, I do remember that. And that was just, you know, sort of a leap of faith. Ticket sales had not slowed down. We were regularly sold out 3-4 weeks in advance. And, you know, once again, that's part of that perfect storm because it was a small theater. We only had 150 seats. It kept that supply and demand thing going on. There was only so many seats. And so it's just funny how human nature works. When something becomes hard to get, you want it more, you know. And so we were kind of like something that was hard to come by, and so it kept demand up. But my gosh, Terry, we did, you know, in that first section there, in just within Mill Avenue Theater, we did well over a year. I know we did over 200 performers. I still have my 200 performance t-shirt somewhere. So it just, and you know, the thing was, is it, because it was so topical, things kept happening. So we kept revising the script. And so not only were people coming back to bring their friends, then they saw, oh, here's a new scene based on Charlie Keating or Ascam or something, you know, like that.
So share a little bit of that. The musical was set up in a way that really, because the politics here in Arizona never left you without material for a good right. long while.
And, oh, yeah. I mean, also, the first half of the show was historical about the Arizona governors, and then the second half was much more of the topical stuff, where we had, you know, I remember one of the biggest laughs of the show, and it was just a side gag, was Evan Meekum coming out dressed as the Energizer Bunny with the rabbit ears and the drum and the puffy tail and all that, and he keeps running and running and running. And so things like the savings and loan scandal with Charles Keating happened. When Ascam, do you remember when Tony Stadino, the mafia guy, came in and
tell the story, milk it for us.
They could not get a picture of this guy the day before,
refresh everybody about Ascam real quick, because there might be listeners who don't know.
Probably most of them. Maybe. So Ascam was sort of an entrapment thing, really, that the government had set up. The idea was that someone was trying to bring Indian gaming to Arizona. And when you look at all the casinos that are here now, it seems like kind of a ridiculous thing to even be talking about. But the attorney general set up this guy whose name was Tony Stadino. And he was like out of a 1960s mafia picture, this guy, he was, you know, hey, you, baba, da, you know, he was just a cliche. And they had videotape of him setting paper bags full of money on the desk and the legislators reaching out and scooping up this cash. And, you know, a lot of people, and these were the same legislators who had not long before voted to impeach Evan Meekum, were now on videotape taking cash from this oily mafia guy to buy their vote to bring Indian gaming to Arizona. So the media, this became a big deal. Tony Stadino's face was pixelated in the video, so you couldn't see his face, and everybody wanted to know what this guy looked like. But his attorney would not allow him to have his picture taken. And the day before, they were across the street from our theater at the Tempe Palms Hotel, and they actually put a big rubber plant out on stage so the Stadino could stand behind it and talk to the press, but the plant was camouflaging him from anybody taking his picture. The next day, this guy walks into our theater with big sunglasses, and I said, I looked at him and I said, "Are you who I think you are?" And he goes, "Shh," and walks in and sits down. So after the show, I went back up to him and I said, "Would you mind posing for some pictures with the cast?" He said, "Sure." So we bring him on stage. And here he is, the guy who the day before had been standing behind the rubber tree, handing out money, handing out cash to the cast members, you know, waving at the camera, shaking. And I got on the phone. While they were taking the pictures, I got on the phone with the Arizona Republic, and I said, "You're not going to believe this, but I've got Tony Stadino in my theater right now, and we're taking pictures of him." And they went, "Ah, yeah, right." They didn't believe me. So the next day, we sent them a picture. And as I recall, for at least a couple of months, anytime they did a story about Tony Stadino, they used that photograph standing on our stage with the cast of Gov, because nobody else had any other kind of picture of him. So anyway.
No, that is the best story ever. And I remember at intermission or halftime that you came back and said, I don't believe this, but I do believe Tony is in the audience. And we're like, what? But like, even that, like you talk about a perfect storm. This was a storm that went on for a good while, because like, yeah. Who can buy that kind of advertising? advertising. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Here he is in the audience. Mm-hmm. Then he stays for pictures. And yeah. then the Republic doesn't believe you. So mm-hmm. they get a picture. And then every time they speak of him for a good while later, you know what I mean? Like, what? How did that happen? And then we did have other very notable people that came to the show. Do you recall any of them?
Oh, yeah. You know, I think one of my favorites was Barry Goldwater.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say.
And he came to see it a couple of times and brought friends with him. And we portrayed him as, speaking of mafia, we portrayed him as the godfather of Arizona politics. So he was talking with this kind of Italian accent, you know.
Brent Pryor played him, correct?
Yes, he did. And he Goldwater loved it. He had a really good sense of humor about himself. And
he stayed after the show. He came to a matinee one day and mm-hmm. stayed, and he visited with us.
Yes, he did.
On a weekend where we didn't have a show afterwards, but we all got to sit around with him for a little bit. He hung out.
Yeah, that was cool. And Bruce Babbitt and some other. Oh, hold on a second. Sorry about that.
No worries.
Go away. Okay.
Nope.
Bruce Babbitt and then I remember the night that Fife Symington, Governor Symington, bought the whole house as a fundraiser. So we sold him the house at the regular price. And then he turned around and marked the tickets up like 200% or something like that for a fundraiser. And I remember that when he showed up, we were going to walk through it with him the day of the show. And he, of course, had a security detail with him. And we just wrapped things up and they were about to leave. And then Bruce says, oh, you know, I forgot to mention, there's a point in the show where we fire a blank gun. Is that going to be a problem? And his security detail went, let us see the gun. And he said, well, it's not really a gun. It's a starter's pistol. And so they went in and they took the whole thing apart and they looked at it and everything. And then they okayed it because, you know, the gun was a starter's pistol. It didn't even have a barrel on it. It just had, there was no hole in the end of it.
Right.
So, I just had thought to myself, what if we had never mentioned to his security detail that we were firing a gun, and then we just decided to fire a gun? I think Bruce probably would have been hogtied on the stage floor in about 2 seconds. So, I mean, just things like that that would never be part of any other stage production, things that come up like that, and it still to this day, the single most unique experience I've ever had in any kind of stage play.
Oh yeah, me too. And it did go on. I know we took it to other cities, towns in Arizona. Did Yuma?
We went to Tucson. We went to Flagstaff, Prescott, Yuma. We did it for the Arizona Bar Association. It just became a thing that everybody wanted to be a part of. And wow, I mean, you know, how do you set out to do something like that? You can't. It's impossible. It just, all the pieces just happen to fall in place at the right time, and that's it. There'll never be anything else like it, I don't think.
I don't see how it could. I know that, you know, in remembering those days, I'm a person of nostalgia anyway. I love the feeling of let's reminisce. But when I go back and think about those days and think about the travel that we did together, there were times that we were just out on the balcony there at the staircase, up on the, you know, hanging out before the show. We were, and I know this happens in casts anyway, but we were this family that rode this really wild ride. I mean, most of us had our pictures in the paper.
A lot.
And initially, I mean, we were on the news. I remember my mom saying, you were on the news, right? And then, and like, they would even be standing down there in the parking lot waiting for, you know, interviews with you guys and stuff. But it did something to me in a really good way that, I mean, there's nothing else that I could ever imagine topping that experience in its totality because of all that it brought to my life. What did it do for your life?
Well, it set me on a track. It set me on a track to write plays, what I call Arizona-centric plays. I've written more than a few, and it sounds limiting, and I can even narrow it down more than that. Not just Arizona-centric, contemporary history. History that has taken place within the living memory of people. And that's a lot of what Gov was. So when Gov had finally closed down and we closed down the theater, I decided to write what they call now a solo show, about Barry Goldwater. And because Goldwater had come to see the play, I thought, well, you know, maybe I could at least get his endorsement for it. I sent him a copy of the script. He invited me up to his house. We sat and talked about it, and he had obviously read it because he was talking about it in great detail. Before I left his house that day, he said, "What is the setting?" And I said, well, pointing around his house, I said, "It's your living room." And he said, "Well, maybe you need some stuff to decorate the set then. Why don't you take some of these Indian baskets and these Kachina dolls?" And I was like, because I knew they were the real deal, extremely valuable, and I kind of hesitated at first. And he says, no, it's okay. And he went and got a cardboard box and just started putting these things in the box. And then his wife came in and said, you know, I bought a suit for him a while ago, and I don't think he's ever going to wear it again. Why don't you take the suit? The actor can wear that.
No way!
And then he went into a closet and pulled out this leather aviator's jacket that he wore during World War II and said, here, you can use this too. And so I walked out of there with probably several thousand dollars worth of artifacts, and we did the show. And then I took it back and I returned all the stuff to him.
Who played that? Hamilton
Mitchell.
Hamilton Mitchell, he was
great. And Barry came to see it and loved it. Anyway, so I handed all the stuff back to him, and then the last thing I had was this flight jacket, and he said, are you going to do the show again? And I said, well, I hope so. And he said, why don't you just keep that?
No way.
I did, and I still have it. And it's like one of my most treasured possessions of all time. I'll just compress this a little bit. So Goldwater, and then after that, I wrote a show about another kids television show that I had grown up watching called The Wallace and Ladmo Show. And that's had probably about 8 different productions here in the Valley. And then I wrote another one about a POW escape that happened up at McDowell Road and 56th Street, which is now an Air Force Reserve base. During World War II, it was a POW camp. And I have just, it put me on the path of writing about Arizona that's not cowboys and Indians. Mm-hmm. You've got, you know, a show about a statesman, a show about a kid show, a show about a POW escape. They're really vastly different in their subject matter. What they have in common is that it all took place here. And I'm continuing to do that to this day. I just finished writing a play with a very good friend of mine, Kathy Dressbach, who I know you know.
Yes.
And we wrote a play called The Truth About Winnie Ruth Judd. And Winnie Ruth Judd is a woman who was involved in a double homicide in the 1930s in Phoenix. It's still an unsolved murder. No one will ever know the truth about Winnie Ruth Judd, which is why we gave it that name. It's supposed to be kind of ironic. It would be like the truth about Amelia Earhart or something like that. No one will ever know that answer. And I am currently writing something that is quite different for me. I'm working on a farce, and a farce is something I've always wanted to write, but never had the right way to do it. So I'm about halfway through it. It's called Go West, and it revolves around Mae West visiting Phoenix in the 1930s for the opening of her film, I'm No Angel. And it all takes place in the San Carlos Hotel. A hotel is the perfect place for a farce, mistaken identity, slamming doors, people up and down stairs. And the lovely thing about this is I'm making it up. It's there's about that much history involved in it, and the rest of it is just completely made up. So
I love it.
Yeah, who knows if that's ever going to get produced anywhere? But being in quarantine now, it's nice to have something to work on.
Oh, for sure.
I'm having fun writing it.
You have family.
Yes.
You want to talk about them a little bit?
Sure. I have three sons and one daughter. I'm married to, and this means nothing to some people. To some people, they would go, oh, my wife's name is Helen Hayes. And she was the other Helen Hayes, the real Helen Hayes, was quite a famous actress in her day. And I met Helen in the theater. We've been married for 27 years now.
Oh, yeah, I was at your wedding.
Yes, you were. It was, and we got married in the lobby at the Herberger Hotel. Mm-hmm. And we spent our honeymoon, by the way, at the San Carlos Hotel. Our wedding night at the San Carlos Hotel, where this whole Mae West story takes place. So my sons are pretty much grown up and on their way. My daughter is...
Michael is one of them?
Michael's my youngest. Brian's my middle boy. And the oldest guy is TJ.
CJ, I don't mean to interrupt you.
TJ.
TJ, sorry. TJ.
Yeah,
TJ.
It's okay.
My bad. I thought you said CJ and I didn't remember it. But
he remembers you.
I know. I would think that he would. And I want to shout out to him if he's listening. Because he was such a joy. And, you know, I, as I shared, I didn't have children. But I love children. And there was a bit of a ritual that you were always present for, I need to say.
Oh, yes.
But I would, he would cooperate, but yes. He would kind of sit on my lap. How old was he then?
Probably about five years old, somewhere around there.
So he would sort of lay down on my lap and I would begin to prepare him by seasoning him with salt and pepper.
And to this day, he calls you the salt and pepper lady.
Well, you know, I have been called worse. That's a compliment. But, the first time we did it, he laughed and giggled and laughed and giggled, and it was like, okay, right on, we have this relationship now. But he would come and it was almost like, are we ready? And he would lay across on my lap like a dead person, and I would salt and pepper him. So I don't know when.
I was gonna say, don't forget that you devoured him.
Yes, I would. Yes, I dined upon his belly. But I've never done that to anybody since. It must have just been destined for he and I to have that connection. But how is he?
He's doing well. He is. He got a degree in chemistry at ASU, and he is now. I'm sure he won't mind me saying this because it's nothing, there's nothing untoward about it. He is now working at a medical marijuana dispensary and using his chemistry skills to determine the level of whatever it is that, you know, in weed that causes the effect.
Got it. So, okay.
He's doing that. He's happy. My middle son is a welder. He's a certified welder, doing very well. And my youngest boy, Michael, pardon me, is a teacher now. He's teaching American history at Arizona Preparatory Academy.
Seriously.
And teaching online right now. As a matter of fact, right now, he's probably in class. They have all flown the coop and are doing well.
What about your daughter?
My daughter is Anna, and she will be 18 in January, and she's a special needs kid. She is autistic, and I tell you, after having three boys, I wanted a girl really bad, and so we ended up getting a girl, and we ended up getting a special girl, and I have learned so much from her and dealing with her condition and how it manifests itself. And she's a joy. My wife and I are both raising her. I don't know that she, I don't want to, one of the things I learned is never to underestimate her.
Yeah.
But I would be pretty sure that she would never be able to live independently.
Okay.
But she is in many ways so insightful and does things that just are amazing to me. And I feel, and I know Helen feels the same way. We just feel blessed and very fortunate to have her in our lives.
Wow, that's awesome, Ben.
Yeah.
You know, I have a really dear longtime girlfriend in California that has an autistic daughter that lives with her. I think she's probably, gosh, in her, well into her 20s now. Yeah. And she says the same thing, you know, the things that she has learned from her daughter that would not have come by her any other way. Is there anything, right. I'm sure we have some people listening that, I mean, I know we do. Is there anything that you would like to share just about how that has enlightened you? I know you said you learned a lot and some of it's probably private, but just.
No. I mean, obviously I'm not going to, anything I say, I'm going to feel comfortable saying.
Okay.
They say if you've met one autistic kid, you've met one autistic kid, because they are all unique. They're all different. They do have some similarities, but what I think that I have learned and Helen as well is to look at the world in a completely different perspective, to see things in a way that a neurotypical person like you and me would see one way. A person with autism would see in a completely different way, but there is a logic to it. And if you understand that, it helps you communicate with them and understand what they're doing and saying and why they're doing what they're saying. So it has just caused me to have, I mean, without getting into minutia, it's just caused me and my wife to just look at the whole world differently. Now, she has done some things I got to tell you are pretty damn funny now, not so funny at the moment, at the time that it happened. When she was about, maybe 7 or 8 years old, Helen had begun having conversations with her, like you would with any kid only much younger, about your body and what the actual names for things are. And so... naming body parts, for example, okay? I'm standing in line at the grocery store to check out with my daughter, and everything's going along normal. And all of a sudden, at the top of her lungs, she shouts, and she can be very loud, "My vagina!" And everything froze. And everyone turned and looked at me, and I was just on the spot, and I felt like I had to say something. I didn't know what to say. And I said, "She has one." And that's all I could come up with. But, you know, I have noticed that people in public have become, I think the degree, the level of understanding and not being put off. There were times when, you know, she would have an outburst or something like that in public, and people would look at me like, "Can't you control your kid?" But then, you know, times like that, I think people understood that that there was something else going on. And so nobody was judgmental or said anything. But oh my gosh. I mean, that's just one example. There's been so many times when she has just decided to say or do something that is, you know, not normal, not what we would consider socially normal. So those are the effects it has on you. You have to learn how to look at life differently, how to deal with life differently. And that's just examples. So, my vagina has been sort of a little code word that we use now when there is an outburst somewhere that's unexpected.
The response that you had to her, she has one. It's that tickles me so much about you. I mean, you have a fabulous, fabulous sense of humor. It's dry. It's quick. And it's also succinct. And I know that the ability you have as an actor, you know, helps infuse how you communicate your humor. I know that there's something that you said to me, not in the same kind of feeling like that. It's this very quick response that I might have been sharing something with you, and I know I have a lot of words. So I was sharing something with you, and we were at the theater, and you said, sad in a way. And I'm pretty sure I wet myself. I think it was just, and then that became a thing with you and I, but it was never old. You would say it at a time where you just waited, I don't know, and it came. But that kind of humor, I'm getting choked up a little bit because I love you. And I love that you affect me that way because I love to hear laughter and I love to laugh. But talk about a medicine, and to hear that you have parented and are parenting still, mm-hmm. Four children, and to be able to have that as a gift. I know that children and parents have all sorts of relationships, but I know that your humor has had to have been a blessing to your children. And even in that way that you just sort of like graciously like acknowledged your daughter with something simplistic. And I know you weren't setting out for a ba-dum-bum, but it was
not at all.
And the thing about humor that makes humor so good and that really makes comedy is that you know when you get a response from someone that they identify with it out of the truthfulness of it. And so you were so truthful. But before we go here, my friend, and I appreciate you so much. There's so much to talk about. But how has humor, how has humor affected your life, and how do you see it even now in these days? Like, it's in what way does humor do something for you? Because I know your humor does something for me, but in what ways does it do something for you?
Well, it's restorative. That's what it is for me. And, you know, you mentioned the truth. And that is often what we laugh at when something is so, when something happens that is so on the money, that is just so there, that is what makes you laugh. And I think when we are laughing, it's probably when we are most relaxed and feeling the best that we can ever feel. And, you know, like a lot of people who I've either heard interviewed or talked with, the idea of pursuing humor, of trying to generate humor, is something that comes really early on in your life. And it was something that I recognized as a young person that not everyone did or could do, and that it made me feel good, that it made my friends feel good, that it was something I enjoyed. And I just always felt that whole business of being able to laugh at something can just be completely the most valuable thing that anybody could have. And it's so ethereal. It's not something you can hold in your hands. It's just out there kind of floating around in the ether, you know?
Exactly.
But if you can direct it, if you can generate it, if you can aim it, focus it, and fire, that it is one of the most powerful things on earth. And it's just, for those reasons, I think is super, super attractive to a lot of people.
Well, you said it, and it takes us back to how I started this conversation with you, that you powerfully have affected my life. And in great part, obviously inviting me into an experience that none of us saw ahead of time that would go the way that it did in Gov. But above and beyond that, it might seem silly, but I come back so often just to hearing you say the saddened way, and as only you can say it. And it really did, you know, if you think about me being long-winded and sharing a story with you, it was a very gracious response. But the way that it makes me feel about you is because it is so powerful, and you gifted that to me. So, and then here you
get... Well, now hold on just a second. I mean, that is something that is part of your makeup. That is something that is, you know, if I could just jump back for, and I'll give you an example of this. When you were talking about your Rose Mofford audition, the reason we had you doing that, what you did come up to the podium and not say anything, was grounded in reality. We had just gotten rid of Evan Meekum. Our new governor had just, like, days later, taken over, and everyone's going... Thank God, Rose Mofford, this is someone we can trust. Well, she was at a ceremony. The Arizona Cardinals had just come to Phoenix. At that time, they were called the Phoenix Cardinals. They're sitting up on the dais, and the coach of the Cardinals, the back two legs of his chair started to go off the back of the podium, and he went like this and clotheslined Rose Mofford, knocked her off the back of the podium, and... The news reports were saying the governor is experiencing strange headaches. And, I mean, it was just like, no! We just got a rational governor. She got clotheslined by the football coach, and now she's having headaches. So our interpretation of that was someone who couldn't quite string words together in a sentence. And that's all we gave you to go with. And you took that and ran several football field lengths with it, and it was brilliant. It was beautiful.
Thank you, Ben. I mean, I remember the audition so well, and I remember you responding to me, and you being a comedian, you know what that's like when someone mm-hmm. reacts. Yeah. You know what I mean? You're in that spot, and it would so that even of itself was a gift to me. To get to do that. And I know you, I remember you standing there trying to explain who she was to me and sort of what she looked like. And I wasn't sure how, if I was taking that as a compliment or not, that you saw me in her, but I was processing those eyelashes and whatever. And it was just, it was a radical life-changing experience. Well, it put me here in Arizona, essentially. Yeah. I mean, one thing led to another.
As it does.
And then everything that came, you know, from there, really, it created a left turn that, you know, the trajectory of my life really can be traced back over the past 30 years to that event. But I just really want to thank you for your friendship. And it is a cool feeling, though it is daunting a little bit to make myself say it out loud, that it's been 30 years, but to have a relationship with someone, I don't see you every day, no. You know, but I know even in when we were messaging back and forth, just the nature of the relationship is still in there, and it's just a good one, and you're a good guy, and I
thank you, Terry.
So much for bringing laughter and all those powerful feelings into my life, not to mention the opportunity. And I hope you will come back again. Please say hello to Helen for me.
And, I will.
And get a little salt and pepper out for TJ, just to, you know.
I'm going to tell him you and I talked.
Yeah. And I love you, my friend. Hang on the line. And if you agree to it, I'll love to schedule something where you can come back and we dig in a little bit more to some wonderful things about you, okay?
Sure.
All right, sweetheart, hang on.
Love you too, Terry. It was great talking with you.
Thank you so much.
You bet.
Of course, as I have said over and over and over again, that I love Ben because he makes me laugh. But today I was reminded of other reasons why I love Ben. He has a really good heart, and he's a sensitive guy, and he's clearly a good dad. Just what he shared today helped me see him yet even still in a new light, that and that light being bright. I've known that about Ben, but hearing him share about his connection and his relationship with his daughter just endears me to him even more. I hope you loved him. He'll be back. We'll be doing things together. And thank you again for listening. I do hope that you rate and subscribe and share and all of those things that podcasters are supposed to say. But I guess it does matter in the long run that we get noticed in some fashion. So if you would do that, it would be awesome. And if you have any questions for me, I love asking questions, but I gotta tell you, it sort of flips my switch when people ask me questions. So ask me some questions, y'all. You can send them to, go to my website, terrysummers.com/podcast. And I spell my name kind of funky, TerrySummers.com/podcast. You guys have a great day. This was such a great day. Thank you, Ben Tyler.